Just a prelude to my homily. The Sadducees were, I consider them, they were the conservatives. They were the fundamentalists of the time of Jesus. They believed in only what the Torah said, the written Torah. They didn't believe in tradition. So they are reciting here or citing the law, the Levirate law that is found in Leviticus about taking care of one's family and marrying the wife if she doesn't bear a child. So they were people of the book. They're like our fundamentalists today. If it's not in there. So they asked this question of Jesus, which is a ridiculous question to begin with, and then Jesus, of course, gives them the answer to that. And I'll get to about resurrection in a minute here or so. But anyhow, and they believed that Moses had written the Torah, when we know that Moses was dead for hundreds of years before the Torah was written. We know that today. I want to start with the prayer. I don't usually start with the prayer, but I'm going to start with the prayer today. May God, if there is a God, save your soul if you have a soul. Amen. That's my agnostic prayer. When I was agnostic, I used to pray like that. I learned that prayer a long time ago. You got to have a bit of agnosticism in you if you're going to have faith. I wouldn't know where I would be today if it wasn't my questioning and my doubts. And when I read more and more of the saints' life, not that I'm a saint, but they went through terrible times of doubts and struggle and darkness and all the rest of it to get to their faith. And the more your trials and errors and the things you go through, the stronger your faith becomes. I appreciate people who've never questioned anything in their faith, who've never doubted anything. My God, you are going to be so blessed. But genuine faith in God always has an element of agnosticism. And in classical language, the human creature is capable of the infinite, capex infinity. We can acknowledge the transcendent reality of God. And it's more than this blind recognition that, yeah, there's something more. No, it's more than that. We know. But it's not an exhaustive knowledge that we have. We cannot know the divine reality in so complete a way that God becomes a mental possession. And yet that's what I think with a lot of people. God is a mental possession. We try to contain God. We use it in our creeds and dogmas. We try to define God. And so our knowledge of God really illumines a relationship. But there's always more to a relationship than we know. And at the heart of the knowledge of faith is a humble not knowing. But yet today, there are so many people out there that are so sure and have such certitude about God and about things that it just blows my mind. There's no humility there. There should be a theology of humility or a humble theology. At the heart of the knowledge of faith is a humble not knowing. It is this not knowing that keeps us off balance and fearful. But it is also this not knowing that leads us to trust, to faith, i.e. faith, trust, i.e. faith. I'm sorry to tell you that the framework of the infinite God and the finite human knower is a permanent condition. And it's not changed by revelation. In fact, it's exasperated by revelation. Every revelation of God is simultaneously concealment of God. The divine human relationship is an essential mystery. But we don't like mystery. We don't like to live in mystery. The more we know about it, the more we know we don't know that there's more to it. For example, the core Christian revelation, what is that? What's the core Christian revelation, by the way? God is love. That's the core Christian revelation, right? God is love. That brings light into darkness, that God is love. And that this ultimate reality we call God is gracious towards all who participate in this reality. But how is this graciousness carried out? How is it manifested in our world that looks like it's all about random destruction and chaos? So this revelation, God is love, it does not clear up the mystery. It only deepens it to me. It's difficult to live in the combination of knowing and not knowing, of revelation, concealment. And yet that's where we live. There's a strong drive in people for certitude. They want certitude. Give me the answers. Show me out. It says in the Bible, I want the answers. I don't want to have to live the questions. It's too difficult. I want certitude. A common sense wisdom puts it, when we know for sure, we know what we're dealing with, and then we calm down. It is not knowing that creates sleep deprivation, anxiety. This hunger for certitude is particularly evident when we ponder the question of life after death. Have you noticed today all these books coming out? I haven't been to a bookstore in a while, but the section with these books about heaven, people want to know. I mean, I even promoted that book, Proof of Heaven, but then there's one like this little kid on the front cover, Heaven is Real, and we want certitude. It's a big industry today to describe what happens after life, because people want to know. And throughout the history of Christianity, there's been a lot written about heaven and hell and purgatory and all that. Very graphic stuff, really imaginative. I mean, Dante was great. He was wonderful when it came to describing the afterlife, as he saw it in those days. But you know what? Does personal consciousness survive the death of the body-mind? And if so, then what awaits us if consciousness survives the death of the body-mind? What awaits us after that? Well, I can tell you this. Personally, I don't know what your beliefs are, but I believe that the consciousness does. And Proof of Heaven proves that to me in a lot of ways, but I didn't have to have Proof of Heaven for that. But then what awaits us is, well, you're just going to have to wait. I don't know. You do, but I don't know. Who does? Can those who have died and those who are still alive communicate with one another? Can they help each other in their respective journeys in life? I don't know about you, but I say yes, yes. It's in my world. The Christian tradition, as I said, has not been shy in responding to these questions. Therefore, we've been feeding the hunger for certitude that those questions are generated from. We have these precise theological elaborations about afterlife conditions, stories of heaven and hell and purgatory. And whether these theologies and whether these stories are accurate representations of life after death is debated in the church, in the faith, in those outside the faith. Now, I'm not going to go into all these stories. Some of you know the stories. Some of us were taught the stories when we were very small. And we were literally had the fear of hell because of what was going to happen. They're put into us. Why was that belief about hell and all that put into us? Well, I guess it was so that we would walk the straight and narrow. We would live a moral life. I don't know. But then there's stories of heaven, and that consoles people to know, hey, my mom, my pop, they're with God, and God takes care of them, and they're okay. And, you know, so there's all these stories we have, and all these ideas we have, but they're all in imagination. There's nothing we know for sure. At least, I don't know. Maybe you do. Let me know after church, please. We all have our own individual understanding, our beliefs. And so they affect the way that we live in this world. As I often said, your beliefs are going to affect the way you live. So what is your belief about the afterlife? Because it affects how you live in this life in some way. How do you understand the resurrection? How does the resurrection affect your life? Does it? Let me just say personally, for me, the resurrection makes it possible for me to live in hope and to trust in the future. That's what it does for me. Beyond that, well, there's some things, but like so many other things of God's great gifts to us, the experience of the resurrection should not be relegated to eternity. It shouldn't be relegated to the next life. Like salvation, resurrection should be tasted in the here and the now. Jesus was not interested in afterlife scenarios. He wasn't interested in the afterlife to begin with. He was concerned with this life, with this world, with liberating people in this life. and not about the next life. But we made it all about him in the next life for some reason. But he never even spoke about what happens except the fact that everyone lives in God, even the dead. That's as far as he goes. Just ask you one question and I'll end. After the resurrection, all the resurrection stories, all the accounts, which are all different, but after all of them, tell me one thing that Jesus said about the afterlife. I'll wait. You can't think of anything? I'm talking about, what did he say about the afterlife? How did he describe it? How wonderful was it, you know, with the angels and the horns and the harps? Now, he didn't say anything. He didn't reveal anything about what it is, only that it is. So we are left with what? Faith. Trust. We don't know. You're going to hear me say in the prayer consecration that we pray for those who have gone on before us or for those who have died in the hope of the resurrection. Not in the certitude, but in the hope of it. We live, as Paul says, as people of hope. We hope that death doesn't have the last word, but that life does. And we can have that hope, and we can pretty much, it helps us, because we know that God is a God of life. And we can learn a lot from even science these days that tells us that life doesn't end. Life changes. It does not end. St. Paul said, eye has not seen, ear has not heard, it hasn't dawned on the imagination of humankind what God has in store for those whom he loves. And he loves us all. So he has a great deal in store for you. So we can actually have hope in something more wonderful than we are have now. And I believe that there will be something more wonderful. And I have faith in that. Let me say this in the end. For the time being, we Christians need to live a resurrected life now. The first followers of Jesus who experienced the resurrection, their lives were changed. Has your life been changed because you have met the resurrected Lord? I hope you have. And so resurrection means, among other things, that we feed the hungry, that we clothe the naked, that we visit those who are imprisoned or in hospitals. It means that we witness, as they did, to the good news with our lips and with our lives. Resurrection, like salvation, is both existential, here and now, as well as future fulfillment. My brothers and sisters, you don't have to wait until the end of your life and after you die to experience resurrection. Jesus calls us to devote our lives, our time, our talent, whatever treasures we have that we possess, so that others can know the experience of the resurrection in their lives today while they're alive, so that we can trust the future.